I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warriors Radio Network.
All right. You're about to listen to a really important interview that I did a not very good job of framing. And here's why I think it's important. The interview is with Major Janelle Hamp. So, Janelle, first of all, thanks for doing part two of this interview. We appreciate it. And let me just explain to everybody why I think this interview is important. When you look at mental health statistics in the country, I want to say that and you look at serious mental illness. So bipolar, schizophrenic, manically depressed, and those illnesses, they're about 10-11% of the population. Okay, so what is 90% of the population dealing with, right? If they're not categorized by serious mental illnesses. Well, in my opinion, you have people that get overwhelmed, right? And they support families, they're achievers. They come from all different, you know, walks of life. And what I believe, after doing what I've do now for into the fifth year of doing interviews on All Marine Radio, and then, you know, into the second year of doing post-traumatic winning, what my experience is, the problem we have with a lot of destructive behavior, and it ranges from suicide to alcoholism to divorce to domestic violence, is this. It's people that don't have serious mental illnesses, because you can't stay in the military with them, but they're overwhelmed by life. My experience is that a lot of times it's stuff that happens to you when you're a kid is part of it. And then there's another segment, I think, that Janelle represents, and that is this. It's people that are achieving, that are working, that aren't taking care of themselves. And they work and they work, and then one day they wake up and they're like, what's happened to me? What's going on? I'm not in control of my life. I don't like the place where I'm at in my head. And so I wanted to bring Janelle on a second time and talk about that stuff before you hear the interview. So I just want to do a little bit better job on my part of framing it. So, Janelle, welcome back to All Marine Radio. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. The interview everybody's going to hear is you talking about your struggle to come to grips with something that you weren't really sure about. How do you explain it when you talk about it?
I'd say it was like a wake up call, really awareness, I would say. I was pushing through in terms of life and assignments and everything, and I wasn't really aware of how I was pushing through it. And I had never been taught, you know, tools to deal with stress and in the way that would have been effective preventative. I learned all of that stuff after the ER visit and everything else, and I think that...
Don't spoil the interview, for God's sakes, man.
Oh,
come on, you're giving it away.
Man.
No.
All right.
Okay, so let me ask you this. No, it's all right. I'm just kidding.
Well, I think maybe I could just say what I realize now is that once I shared my story with other peers and other parents, like, everybody could relate to just that level of dealing with life and stress and not knowing how to deal with it effectively.
Okay. So let me ask you this. So did you think that were you at all aware that you might be susceptible to prolonged stress, prolonged mental stress injury, or was your attitude just a, oh no, I'll just power through this too?
I definitely thought when we had, you know, those trainings and they talk about stress continuum, I was like, oh, that doesn't apply to me. I'm above that. I'm stronger than that. And I realized that was, you know, stupidity and pride instead of being honest with myself about my own limits.
The problem with it, though, is it's a little bit of truth, too, though, right? I mean, you'll hear this, but Janelle's a graduate of the Naval Academy, so, I mean, so she's an achiever, and she, you know, was obviously an achiever in high school because she qualified to go there. You know, to graduate, you have to be an achiever, right? She's a female Marine officer, and whether anybody cares to admit this, we expect more out of female. It's not good enough to be okay. Marine officers, female Marine officers constantly have to reprove themselves. And so, and I know that's not fair, but, and I know they feel it, and that's the way it is in the Marine Corps. And when you sign up for that challenge, you don't do that because you're afraid of one. And so conquering things is not a small piece of it. And so the reason I think this interview is so important is that if we don't think that the rules of stress apply to us. And I'll just tell a quick story about myself. I was the operations officer at a unit before I got out of the Marine Corps. We lost our XO. We got a new one. He essentially said, I don't want to work this hard. And he said, I'm going terminal leave. This is not what I came here to do. And it was like, what? And then I got asked, do you mind being the OPSO and the XO? And it was a unit that, a high-tempo unit deploying and redeploying people, forming task force out of different parts of the MEF, deploying, you know, it was a day-on, stay-on job. And you needed about four people to make it go in terms of, you know, on the officer side, you need the OPSO, you need the XO, you need the four, and you need the one. You need those people because you were constantly forming units and tasking units, or the MEF was tasking units. You were gathering them, and they were pushing back, and so it was a nightmare. And that's when I went to therapy for the first time, because I could feel myself. It was something that was wrong. Something was broken. And something I hadn't experienced, and I was feeling hate like I hadn't felt it inside the United States, at least. I felt it overseas like this, but not in the United States. And I knew I was going backwards. But so Janelle and I, she has a similar situation where you were a company commander in the four, yes?
Yep.
And you're, I mean.
For the second time in my career, because that had already happened once in a previous tour.
So you're the logistics officer and a company commander. And so those are both full-time jobs. And she's, you know, and you have a kid, and your husband's employed, but your job is to get stuff done. So I think this interview is really important because I think it speaks to the fact that, and I don't care if you're a civilian now listening, I don't care if you're an active duty Marine, I don't care if you're a reserve Marine, this happens in our lives. Okay, and it might be happening in your civilian life. It might be happening in your military life. But you've got to take care of you, and you've got to know the signs. And, you know, you'll hear Janelle tell her story and talk about the tools that she got afterwards. But this whole thing, how do you say it? Because you're not in denial. You don't even know it's happening to you, right?
Exactly. I think it comes to like a paradigm shift in how we think about mental health and how, you know, hey, you go to the gym to stay in shape because you have this, you know, you have this mindset that like, no matter how fast I am, I can get faster. No matter how strong I am, I can get stronger. And I think if we just take that same drive that we have for physical health and apply it to our mental health across the board, all ranks, all stages of life, you know, regardless of whether you're in the military or not, I think that's the approach that would have helped me learn some of this stuff along the way and start applying it in a way that would have, I think, prevented things from getting to where they were.
So what do you think would have helped you understand this better earlier, would it have been hearing people like you talk, people like me talk? Like, look, I'm, you know, I've always done anything, you know, I put my head to, you know, as a Marine, pretty much in my life. And all of a sudden I find myself, I'm not normal. But, and the reason I ask that is because what I see so much, you know, in terms of destructive behavior numbers, it's people like that. They're not bipolar, schizophrenic. They're overwhelmed. They don't know where to go. They don't want to say anything because they don't want to be deemed a failure. And so they fake it, right? Some resort to alcohol, right? Some, you know, if they isolate themselves, that's when they begin to go down that path that leads to really, really bad stuff, to include suicide. You know, because they don't want anybody to know. It's their little secret that they can't hang anymore. And so what do you think would have made a difference for you? What would have made it more real for you that this was something that did apply to you?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure if there is one solution. I think for me, looking back, you know, the two main tools that I knew to deal with stress were PT, physical training, and drinking. And I think that those are pretty universal among the Marine Corps. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, if you're stressed, just go for a run, or, you know, all right, you get home at the end of the day, you have a beer. But there are so many just like in the moment things that just, you know, basic mindfulness tools that I think more people are now learning through the VA or through other things afterwards, that, you know, maybe if that was just integrated, like maybe if half of the suicide prevention training that we did covered like personal mindfulness tools. 'Cause I feel like we all know, like we all go through training for other suicide prevention stuff, but maybe not like, hey, how do you recognize and have awareness when your own like levels are being reached to like dial back some of those stress reactions? And I think it makes us more, I mean, it made me more efficient in my job and in my life once I learned this stuff. Like I was able to survive COVID a lot better, I think, than some people that maybe COVID was their breaking point. And everything, you know, getting shut down and losing social support. I don't know. I don't really have one answer. I think there's a lot of people that are out there trying to do this. Like, there's so many, you know, once you venture into this realm, you find people like you with post-traumatic winning, you find other organizations out there that are trying to teach people different ways.
Well,
to
I mean,
bring
really, it's the broad spectrum of wellness, mental wellness.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in fact, I'm on the second draft of my book, and one of the sections that's bigger than I ever thought it would be is wellness. I'm like, well, this isn't sexy. I mean, it's not, you know, but it's a big section of the book, you know, maybe for a good reason. And it starts with very, very fundamental stuff. And you've got to do this stuff, right? And so when you go through the Ten Commandments of post-traumatic winning, right, talking about, you know, you've got to talk about it. And you've got to talk about it for you, not for anybody else. You've got to talk about it for you. You've got to take care of your money for you, right? Because you get to a crazy spot like this, and if you're struggling financially, right, you become the Mad Hatter. You become nutsos, right? And I mean, and that those financial problems layered on top of this just accelerate whatever spiral that you're in, right? Add alcohol to it, and then throw in that I don't talk to anybody. So I'm, even though I might be married or I might have a significant other, I've isolated myself. And you can see it's almost predictable. Yep. You know, check that one, check that one, check that one. Okay, man, you are on your way. You've just punched the express ticket for something bad to happen in your life. So, again, you know, it's important that everybody realize that being well mentally, and I will tell you this, I talk to a lot of people. In fact, I'm back here in Camp Lejeune this week, at the end of the week. And today, as a matter of fact, I'll speak to, you know, another couple thousand Marines, doing post-traumatic wounding for the 2nd Marine Division. And, while I'm here, I get to see Marines that I've already helped. I went to lunch with a Marine who wanted me to meet his wife today, who was really struggling last year. He's a completely different human being right now. I mean, and there's a ton of them here. And so it's a wonderful experience, but they've all gone through an epiphany about mental health, that, oh, there is nothing wrong with me. Oh, this is normal. But it seems like we're not doing a good enough job marketing that look, you've got to do this stuff. This is normal behavior. And what's really abnormal is faking like it doesn't affect you and faking like, yeah, you know, it doesn't apply to you. That's what's abnormal. So that's the interview you're going to hear. What else about framing it, Janelle, and understanding it would you tell people?
I think I would just say, you know, if you're walking into this and maybe you're one of those people that feel like it hasn't happened to you, you know, that's probably where I would have placed myself 12 to 14 months ago. I would have been exactly in your shoes being like, yeah, okay, this probably doesn't apply to me. But maybe once you listen to it, you'll recognize some of the signs or things in my story that might be relatable. And I think there's nothing wrong, exactly what you just said, Mac. Like, there's nothing wrong with you. It's completely normal, and it's okay to speak up. And if you start noticing, like, things are sounding really familiar, then, you know, find a trusted friend, reach out to anybody, and start learning the things that can help you. And I think that's just where it starts, like recognizing and then having a determination to get better and not stopping and learning everything you can until you reach that place of mental wellness, and then basically like get yourself in that place where you have this like daily checklist of, you know, okay, I'm doing these things to be physically healthy and I'm doing these things to be mentally healthy. And, you know, and it's not an overnight journey. It's a day on, stay on, months and months. So I think that's what I got.
Okay. All right. No, I mean, I think that's well said. First of all, it does apply to you. It applies to everybody. It would be as ridiculous as somebody say, yeah, physical wellness, that doesn't apply to me. Okay. I mean, we would listen to that and go, wow, that's what an idiot, right? Well, you know, I think if you don't think that, you know, mental wellness applies to you, that's just as idiotic. And so, you know, I think over and over, one of the themes, the horizontal themes of All Marine Radio is this. There's great people that come on this program on a regular basis and talk about their struggles. I mean, you know, Carl Marlanis, Navy Cross recipient from Vietnam. He's a Rhodes Scholar, and he tells a story about bringing groceries in. He's got two little girls. He's on his second marriage, and he's got his hands full of groceries, and he can, you know, and I don't know if men are more guilty of this than women, but he doesn't want to put the grocery down. So he's trying to open the doorknob, but he can't rotate his wrist too much or he's going to drop a bag of groceries. And so he finally gets it open, and it's like, you know, this small victory for man, right? He shoves, he pushes the door open, and one of his little girls had put the chain latch on the door. So he goes to step through the door now, and the door hits the chain, and then he hits the door, and he snaps, drops the groceries, and with both doors, hands, right, he hammers the door off its wooden frame. And his little girls are there like, mommy, right, daddy, right, they go running out of the room. And he felt horrible because he knew he scared them, right? But it's that explosive anger that he had in him, right? And his second wife, involved in mental health, she came out and she sticks her head around the corner and she says, "Did somebody not take their medication today?" And he said, "I think I forgot." And it wasn't a big deal, and she knew how to deal with it, right? But, I mean, Rhodes Scholar, Navy Cross recipient, right? I mean, he's an achiever in life. This stuff is supposed to affect him. And the story he tells about the way he finds out about PTSD is, I think his second wife, they're having an occupational therapy screening thing at his, where he works. And she says, "I think she should go to that." And he says, "Really?" And she says, "Yeah." So anyway, it's typical Vietnam stuff, you know. His kids wake him up in the middle of the night, and they used to say, "I'm not waking him up, you wake him up," right? Because of the crazy stuff he would do, you know? And so anyway, he tells a story that, you know, he goes down and all these people are there, and he finally waits his turn. And so the guy says, "So how can I help you?" He goes, "Well, my wife thought it was a good idea that I come talk to you." And he said, "Well, do you think you have a problem?" He said, "I get angry every once in a while." And the guy says, "Do you sleep through the night?" He said, "No." And most nights, no. And he said, "Is your anger related to anything?" He said, "Well, I'm not sure." And the guy looks at him and says, "Are you a Vietnam vet?" And he says, "I started crying, and my wife had to come get me." He said, "I'd held that in for all those years." And this guy's a best-selling author, right? I mean, again, Rhodes Scholar and all of that. And so you hear these stories on this radio station all the time. And they're normal people. They're achievers. But we, for whatever reason, we're in denial. And just like Janelle, just like me, like we'll pay attention to ourselves physically, but not mentally. For some reason, we're in denial of that. And again, the reason I wanted to Janelle to come on, you know, again and do this kind of preamble to the interview is this. The suicide and destructive behavior problem, in my opinion, in the DOD and in the country, is not fueled by people with mental health, serious mental health illnesses. It's fueled by people that don't have serious mental health issues, that don't know how to deal with the stress that's building in their life. And so they fake it, they get lost in alcohol, and then, you know, their life takes a bad turn, and they're isolated, and then something really bad happens. And so I think Janelle's interview is really important, and I want to thank you for coming on and doing this little blurb with it as well. So without any further ado, Janelle, thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Max.
All right. Janelle's interview coming up next, right here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
One of the cool things about my life these days is things happen to me like out of the blue. And you're going to meet somebody who happened to me out of the blue. And so I get an email on my LinkedIn account from a Marine captain by the name of Janelle Hamp. And she says that her husband, in 1-5, saw post-traumatic winning, and she had a story, and she wanted to talk to me, and we played phone tag and some other stuff. But joining me today is Janelle Hamp. So, Janelle, first of all, Captain Type, United States Marine Corps, welcome to All Marine Radio, and thanks for coming on and doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I actually just got promoted, so...
You're a major?
I am, yes.
Well, congratulations. What are you going to do with all that big money?
Save it for mess dress.
There you go. If you're prudent, you'll find somebody's used stuff. And there you go. That is your first big expense, by the way. So, and you know, it's awful cool too. I mean, I was torn whether I would buy it, and then I thought, come on, man, you have to. It's a pretty cool ensemble. So there you go. First of all, we got to find out about you. Born and raised where?
Vista, California, just down the road.
Get out. You're a Vista girl?
I sure am.
Did you go to Vista High School?
I went to Rancho Buena Vista High School.
Oh, all right. Where do you go to college?
I went to the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh, well, that certainly changes the interview. So now you're going to be held accountable for all that comes out of the Naval Academy. What gets the Naval Academy on your radar? That's a pretty unique road that young people travel down. Probably a little bit more mature, a little bit more focused, a little bit more driven than the rest of us at an early age. How does that get on your radar?
Well, I was in middle school when 9/11 happened, and so that kind of was my first spark towards military service. And
so you got nobody in your family that was in the military?
Well, so my dad is actually a Naval Academy grad, but he was out of the military before I was born, so I never was I never counted myself as a military kid. He didn't really talk about his experience that much.
But you grew up at Vista. Was he a Marine?
Nope, he was Navy. He was a surface warfare officer out of San Diego, and then my parents settled in Vista.
On what ship?
This shows how little he thought. I think I would have to look it up again.
I was on the USS Ranger out of San Diego. I just wondered if he might have been on that ship. So your dad's a Naval Academy guy, but doesn't really talk about it that much. So it's on your horizon. And in middle school, 9/11 happens, and how do you make it reality?
So it was interesting because the night of 9/11, my school had a travel club meeting for a trip that was planned to D.C. and New York every spring.
Right.
And so, you know, we're sitting there thinking about the events of the day, looking at the pictures from previous trips going, you know, is this trip going to happen? But, you know, we went ahead and still planned for it. And so a few months later, I got to go to the East Coast. That was my first trip out there. And we got to visit the monuments in D.C. We got to visit Ground Zero in New York City. And that made a really significant impression on me as a young kid still. I remember our tour guide standing in front of, I think it was either the Korean War Memorial or Vietnam, one of the ones where they have the statues in a field. And he's just talking about, you know,
Korean.
Do you know what the average age of these Marines and the names on that wall? 19 years old. And they, you know, served their country and they died in blood for our country. And, you know, that's why we honor them. And, that just was, I think, you know, I'd say 9/11 was a spark. That was what the wind that blew it into a fire. And I was, not really hell-bent, but I was very committed and focused on that path towards military service. Originally, I thought I wanted to be a pilot because I had a teacher who was a helo pilot in Vietnam, and then over the course of researching, I realized, you know, a few key teachers in the Vista school district were all former Marine officers, and so once I took a step back, I was like, wait, the thing that ties all these people together isn't aviation, it's the fact that they were Marines. And so I knew when I went to the Naval Academy that I wanted to be a Marine officer.
So you go to New York and Washington, D.C. what year?
That was early 2002.
What year in high school are you?
I was in eighth grade at the time.
Whoa. You know, I'll tell you that I didn't get to New York City until 2006. 2006. No, it would have been 2007. By then I'd been to Iraq twice, and they were still working in that city block that was, you know, the World Trade Center. And the pictures don't do it justice. When I remember from across the street, there was retail spaces at the bottom of skyscrapers, and there were steps leading up to the entrance to this store. And, you know, you could walk up on it, and it was a good viewpoint to view into. And you looked into that hole, and it was gargantuan. And I remember standing there as an adult, right? I was probably 47 years old. And thinking, you know, I mean, these people didn't do anything to anybody to deserve this. And I just remember, you know, just feeling the hate, you know, that, you know, I don't know, that one feels. But what was it like, you know, so soon after it happened? I mean, the wreckage was still in that hole when you saw it. What was that like as an eighth grader to see that?
What I remember was the whole walkway up to the viewing area was like wood planks, and it was just a huge makeshift memorial. So people had written in every square inch of the wood. There were flags, there were flowers, just all sorts, you know, so the entire walk up, you're walking on this platform and you just see, you know, handwritings of prayers and names and, messages to people's loved ones. And so you walk, and then, you know, you're walking through this whole thing. You see the flags and, you know, memorabilia, makeshift things that people had left all around it. And then you walk up, and I don't exactly remember. I remember the pit being really big, and just feeling like, wow, this is where it happened. Like, these people just showed up and went to work one day, and, you know, and then we got attacked. And
right. Now, the other thing about that, as just listening to you describe it, is just the raw nature. And, you know, it wasn't like that stuff is like this smooth marble monument that's there now. It was also personal. It was pictures inside document protectors with notes written on it. It was there, you know, like the hat of a fireman. It was, you know, all these very, very personal items that were left there. So, you know, it was pretty, it was a pretty jarring event to see because it was so personal. At least that's, and they had taken a lot of that stuff and put it, I want to say, in Trinity Church. There was some of it. So, obviously, when I was there, the scaffolding that you walked up on was not there anymore. But still, it was intensely personal, these very personal memorials that people put up everywhere there and the things they wrote. Wow. So you go to the Naval Academy, and it's already in your head that you're going to join the Marine Corps. What year did you graduate?
2010,
and then... You obviously go to the basic school, and what do you become?
So my TBS story is a little bit interesting in that, you know, you're only supposed to be there 6 months. I had an extended stay because I got injured. So that really sucked because, you know, you're on top of the world. You're a Naval Academy graduate. There's all these expectations. And, like, buddy rushing through the woods, my knee goes out, and we haven't even done a real fex yet. We're rehearsing for our first fex, and like I tear a couple ligaments in my knee, and it was really a horrible setback at the time. I learned a lot because of it, but it meant that, you know, man, I'm stuck in this place for an extra several months. And I think that was one of my first experiences of, like, taking a step back and realizing, like, everyone has a story. Because once I got rolled into the medical holding platoon, I met everybody else that was in a similar situation. And I realized, like, wait, I can't just judge people because they're injured or broken. Like, some people didn't ask for something bad to happen to them. And now I know what that felt like. Because when I was at the Naval Academy, I kind of had this proud attitude, like, oh, well, that person's just faking an injury because they want to get out of training. They're weak or slow or don't have commitment. And once I got injured, it was a wake-up call, like, no, sometimes this just happens, and you need to learn what that's like.
And truth be told, it happens, you know, a fair amount, because the injury that, you know, you load up people's upper bodies and then you tell them to run through the woods and, you know, all you need to do is step in a hole at the right angle.
Yep.
And your knee goes snap and you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're derailed for 6 to 9 months.
Yep.
And it happens, you know, a lot more than people know. So you go through that experience. And what MOS did you get out of the basic school?
I got 0402, logistics officer.
Is that what you wanted to do?
It was actually my third choice, and I'm really glad that I ended up being a LOGO, but at the time it still kind of felt like a punch to the gut, because you really want your first choice or your second choice. And
what were your first and second choices?
I had human and combat engineers up there. My SPC was an engineer, and he was really pushing me towards engineers or logistics, and I got logistics.
Nice. Since he controls a lot of that, well done, right? So you're a logistician, and then where do you go?
So I checked into Camp Lejeune. I was with 2nd MLG, shuffled around between a couple different units, between OJT before going to Camp Johnson for MOS school, and finished MOS school and then checked into CLB-6 and got ready to start my time in the fleet.
All right, so that takes you now at some point here you get married, yes?
Yes.
All right, and so walk us through your career up to the point of turbulence.
Well, I'd say some of the turbulence started right after MOS school, not in a bad way, so to speak. I got pulled from my unit to fill a spot on a deployment to be a member of a cultural support team attached to a SOTIF going to Afghanistan. So I was like in the queue to pick up a platoon and be a platoon commander. And then the tasker came down, my company commander sits me down and says, hey, you're going. And I said, okay, roger that. And then I'm kind of thrown into a completely different environment, a different workup, new group of people, deploy. And, there were, you know, the deployment itself was, for me personally, like, I never had to fire my weapon. I never had to work on any wounded Marines. But we were in an area that other, like, outposts to our, like, adjacent to our position would get hit by IEDs, and then Afghans would come bringing their IED victims to our position, and we would help stabilize them to get them to the hospital in Lashkargah. So
you were in Helmand?
Yeah.
Okay. You were in Helmand. Give me a takeaway. I mean, that's a different view. Grew up in Vista, go to the Naval Academy, and then Afghanistan, a little bit different than what we know here in the United States. And you're doing, you know, on the work that you're involved in, you get to see a different side of that war, too. Give me a takeaway from that deployment.
I think there's I mean, I grew a lot on that deployment. It's the only one that I've had, so I'm proud that I was able to deploy. I think I saw the best and worst of people. I mean, Afghanistan was a fucked up place. I think any of us that have spent enough time out there saw the good and the bad in the villagers that we worked with or the people that we worked with. Being a woman in that environment was definitely interesting, and I think I was overly optimistic about some things because, you know, you read Three Cups of Tea and you're like, oh, wonderful, Afghanistan, girls are going to school. Not in Helmand. And just seeing a place that was still so, like, Middle Ages in how it treated people was it was just surprising in one aspect. And also there was a sense of futility knowing that eventually we were going to leave and all the relationships that we had built with the people in our area could backfire on them as soon as we left. And we were right next to a school for local boys in that village, and like there would be times I still dream about the boys that I worked with when we were there, because they would come up to us every day and we would try to exchange a few phrases in English or Pashto and spend time with them. And it was before I was a mom, but I just still see their faces a lot and I wonder what happened to them, and don't expect the best based off of how that whole, you know, how everything's turned out. But, you know, I don't know.
So you say the turbulence starts there. Explain that.
When I came back from that deployment, I mean, I could definitely feel as the deployment went on, like, I didn't really have the tools to deal with what I was dealing with. I had a copy of On Combat, and I read that, and there was a lot in that book that helped me at the time. And as soon as I got back, I was able to take some leave and decompress a bit. But ultimately, like, that was kind of just, I guess, a Band-Aid to some extent. And we got chopped, like, I was TAD to that unit, and so I got chopped back to my normal command and was with a bunch of people who had no idea what I'd been through, no idea even the program that I'd been a part of, because it was such a small, weird thing in the Marine Corps. And then I just sort of had to, like, compartmentalize that and learn my regular job. And one of my things that I've seen, like, because I'm married to an infantry officer, like, he has had the, in some cases, like, the same community of people for, like, 2 to 3 years at a time. So they go through everything together with your group of peers, and then you can work through it and talk through it and then, like, move on. And it was definitely, like, being a woman in the Marine Corps is one thing. Being a female officer is one thing. Like, you're already a minority. And then being thrown into something and then kind of yanked out of it when you're still kind of working through stuff is like, so what was that? I don't know. All right, I guess I won't talk about it. Move on. And I think that worked for a while.
What you're describing is pretty solitary relative to what most people believe the Marine experience is about, which is being part of a team. What you're describing is being not being part of a team.
I think that's what it felt like, because we were together as a team for the deployment, and then once the deployment ended, we were all back to our parent commands across the country.
Right.
And there was like one CST reunion in 2016. That was a really awesome experience. But other than that, it's only kind of been as our paths have crossed again, have I been able to sort of reconnect with some of the other women that had these experiences.
Got it. So you come back to CONUS, you go back to you know, Camp Lejeune, and you get back about life. You start to do your thing. What do you do?
We get back to Lejeune. My husband and I had we were still dating at the time, but we had overlapping deployments. When I was deployed to Afghanistan, he was on a deployment. I came back, and then he came back a few months later. Surprise, I, got pregnant as soon as we were back together again. And then I'm, a lieutenant in my unit now, dealing with going to be a new mom, and he and I get married, finish EWS blended seminar program, and shortly after I pin on captain, I get dual hatted at my unit as a company commander and S4, and as I tell people, the only reason and during that period of time, my husband deploys again. So before I come back off maternity leave to start being dual-hatted, my husband deploys again when our son is 4 weeks old. And the only reason I got through that deployment was the help that I got from my mom and my mother-in-law, because there's just no way I could have, stayed alive and kept my kid alive trying to be doing everything that, all of the responsibility of those units, of those billets. And I had a really awesome CO and a really awesome staff, but, that was a really challenging time for me.
So did your mom and your mother-in-law, did they come out and stay with you and help you?
Yep. We were in North Carolina, and they basically took shifts flying out from California to spend time with me and basically take care of everything else, so that all I had to do when I came home was feed my son and fall asleep and prep for the next day. And that was pretty much my life for 5 months.
A single mom in the Marine Corps, not the easiest job in the world.
No. And I can only imagine how much harder it is for others who don't have family support and don't have financial resources of being a dual officer couple. So I know, I recognize that I'm very blessed, but it's also difficult. And a lot of my friends have gotten out at that stage because they didn't have the support. But it isn't something that you can do alone through all that.
Got it. Got it. All right. So the turbulence at this point is just what's going on in your head.
What continues on, I think, is that I wasn't taking care of myself, and I didn't know how to take care of myself, and over the course of
So what does that mean in taking care of yourself in terms of physical fitness, mental fitness, in terms of nutrition? What does it mean?
It all came to a head about last year, and it had to do with I literally burned out. I got to the point where I was having nonstop headaches, and I wasn't even realizing it until a doctor was like, you need to start being aware of your headaches. And over the course of unpacking everything, nothing was medically wrong with me, just stress that had built up over time. Because all I had learned up to that point was just push through. And I never learned that, hey, sometimes you really do just need to take a step back and learn how to breathe and ground yourself and, connecting with things, you know, for me, faith was a part of it. Like, I think I probably looked like I was practicing on the outside, but not really internalizing all of that to the point that it could help me get through what I needed to get through. Beating myself up all the time, like perfectionism, like I suck at my job. I don't want to be here. I'm not good at this. And just negativity that just becomes so deep-seated that you stop feeling like it's worth your time. Like, well, if I'm really so bad at this, then why should I keep doing it? You know, if you're in a place where you don't see a way out, you know, maybe I need to make a way out. And not recognizing how you can just take things one day at a time and find, like, celebrate the little wins in a way that you get through it intact.
All right, so now at some point you guys come out here to the West Coast, and tell me how this thing comes to a head, and then tell me, you know, how you cross paths with the whole post-traumatic winning thing.
Yeah, so we started out in – eventually my husband and I got from Lejeune to 29 Palms, which got us closer to family, which was awesome. We had non-deploying billets for a few years out there. And then PCS to Camp Pendleton, and it all came, like, for me, my whole burnout thing came to a head when I had this episode at work where I woke up that morning from, like, really, really dark stress dreams, like, things like I was under attack trying to fight back in this world of war. And it was, just a way to, like, my day started off jacked up. And then in the middle of the day at work, I had this, I was trying to read my notes and talk to other people in my shop. And it got to the point where, I couldn't read. I couldn't look at my notes, and the words that were coming out of my mouth, like, didn't line up with what I was trying to say, and I couldn't think straight. And I'm just, like, looking at my notes and realizing, like, the words coming out of my mouth right now make no sense. My vision was, like, all jacked up, and it was blurry and cloudy, and my head hurt, and I'm like, what is going on with me? And eventually I excused myself, like, go break down and cry in my office. My husband was away at training at the time, so I think we were able to talk on the phone briefly. He was like, hey, you should go to medical. I was like, I can't go to medical, like, you're gone. I need to pick up our kid before I can just, like, go to the hospital or go to medical. Like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I did have a conversation with a peer who was like, yeah, hey, go to medical, just get yourself taken care of. Maybe you should take tomorrow off. And I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. And I thought something was, I thought maybe something's wrong with my brain. Maybe I just need a day off. And like that night when I got home, my neighbor asks me, hey, how are you doing? And, my neighbor's a Marine as well. And so I knew that, like, when he asked me, he was serious. He wasn't just asking to just say hi. And the only thing I could do was just break down crying. And I'm like, I'm not okay. I don't know what's wrong, but I need help. And so we start talking through some game plans of, like, well, like, what am I even going to say when I go to medical? Like, my head hurts? Is that all this is? And, I don't want to walk into my medical, like, as me from my unit and just be like, hi, my head hurts, because I don't think this is that. And eventually we talked through stuff and he's like, you know what? How about my kids watch your son and my wife drives you to the ER tonight? And I just was like, you know what? That sounds like the right thing to do. And so that's what we did. And it wasn't until like I got an IV at the hospital that I felt the pain stop in my head and I realized like, that's what no pain feels like. I don't remember the last time my head didn't hurt. And when I had my follow-up at medical the next day and they were like, hey, start tracking your headaches, see if you can identify your triggers. And I started realizing, like, my head was continuously hurting for, like, day in, day out. And the medication that they gave me wasn't helping. And so this all kind of unpacks over a couple of months. Like, I still have some more breakdowns at work. Clearly, I'm still not doing great. And eventually, I decided, like, eventually it's clear, like, my labs are clear, brain scan clear, like, the behavioral health doc is like, hey, maybe this is just stress. And I'm like, stress? Me? Like, I can handle stress. Like, I went to the Naval Academy. I'm a Marine officer. Why should I not be able to handle stress? And he's like, well, here's some things you should try. I'm like, okay. And so I tried to keep an open mind about everything that they were telling me and actually try all of them. But I still needed more help. And, that was when I eventually decided to self-refer to the CBT skills group on base, which was a 3-week.
Explain to everybody what that means. What is that group?
So it's the, cognitive behavioral therapy skills group, which is run by mental health professionals at Lake O'Neill on Camp Pendleton. And most of the people that are there because they have, an anger issue, an alcohol issue, suicide attempt or suicidal ideation.
Okay.
And the goal is to, like, give you tools to be effective in your life again. It was a 3-week program where for an hour and a half, 4 days a week, you go and you sit in a room and you learn to identify how you're feeling, like negative feelings, negative thoughts, put those things, verbalize them, and then tools and wellness strategies to get better. And I can talk more about that part, I think a little bit later, but I think it was hard for me to talk to my husband about some of this stuff until after he had had the post-traumatic winning, presentation, because then, like, it gave more context for us to, like, talk about, the different strategies that I had learned and how they were helping me. And then, so I came across post-traumatic winning because of the presentation that you had done at his unit, which was about a month after I had finished the CBT skills group.
So as you diagnose or get your hands around your issues, is it simply coping with first of all, I don't know that most people understand the pressure on female Marines. Okay. First of all, you're a Marine. Okay. But you constantly have to prove that you're a Marine. Right? It's not like guys just show up and female Marines are scrutinized in the Marine Corps. And brutally scrutinized. And, so there's pressure. Not only are you a female Marine, you're a female Marine officer. So you're expected to excel, right, to be accepted, in my opinion. So there's that pressure. You go to Afghanistan, you come home, and there's all that, that we see, the life, the death, the tragedy, and that's, and nobody tells us that, but that's never going away. And your mom, your husband deploys. So as you're trying to deal with this, is the problem simply coping with all of that simultaneously? Did you get involved in alcohol? Did you get involved in prescription drugs? As you now look back on it, you know, what was the nature of the problem that you didn't see because you were quote unquote powering through it all the time?
I would say alcohol was definitely a factor. I mean, there was a time in our tour in 29 Palms where, like, between the two of us, we were going through like 2-12 packs a week. Eventually that dialed back, and I think after I saw your 3 goals and 10 commandments, like, I decided to try to cut back, like, way more. And I've been completely sober since January, early January, which I think is another factor in why I'm continuing to be stable now.
The eighth, just for everybody that doesn't know, the 8th commandment is if you deal with significant trauma, right?
You say quit, and I was like, ooh, man, that's
exactly
hard.
I used to fuck around and say stop abusing drugs and alcohol, but that's bullshit. All you do is you're dancing around the truth. And the truth is, based on 4 years of interviewing people that have gone down the path, right, that you've gone down, that I've gone down, the countless people I've met have gone down, the truth is, if you struggle with it, right, that you need to quit. Now, but I had the same reaction that you had when I first saw it. I was like, I can't, as a Marine, I can't say that. Like, I can hear everybody going, click, fuck you, click, 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 click. Dude, not for me. But it's the truth. And if there's one thing that I've always been committed to, I've always been committed to the truth. That no matter what, whether it's talking about future force design or talking about living with trauma or, you know, with adversity in your life, if you're not committed to the truth, then you're not going to get where you need to go. And that's how that, but I had the same reaction that you did. Like, oh man, that is the most un-Marine-like thing that I could ever say. And I remember the first time I said it, I could feel that. That was getting blasted into my head. I can't believe you're saying this shit. But it's the truth. But it's the truth. And so, so that's interesting. So just so everybody knows, commandment number 8, thou shalt not drink.
Yeah.
Thou shalt not drink if thou art affected substantially by trauma. So that's interesting. So he comes home from post-traumatic winning, and what's he say?
I don't remember exactly what he said, but I think it was something to the effect of, like, hey, some of the things that we talked, like, I think he kind of just started talking about what it was,
right.
And then as he recounted some of how different people from the unit got up and talked about stuff that was going on, and then how he talked about the presentation, and then that kind of opened up how we could talk about other things.
Well, and when I did it for 1-5, there's a Lance Corporal who stood up and talked about how he, I want to say, and 3 or 4 of his friends went up to spend the weekend in Huntington Beach. They were out drinking. He said, we weren't, you know, we were buzzed, but we weren't drunk. Came back to the room. We were playing video games. We were going to run across the street before McDonald's closed, and took off running and heard a car slam on its brakes, and one of my good friends was killed. I can hear the 3 sounds of the brakes, the car hitting him, and then his body thudding on the ground, and then us trying to revive him. And, you know, why didn't we see it? Why didn't we stop him? Why didn't we notice if he was too drunk? But to hear him stand up in front of his battalion, my old battalion, for Battalion 5th Marines, I'm watching, and this is a requirement every time I do it. Somebody's got to stand up and tell a story like this, so that people can understand that, yeah, you've come to these classes or programs in the past, but this shit is not going to be like that. And so to me, they stand up and talk right at the front, and I call it the first table flipping moment. Like, and so what I want people to know is, I know you're not sure now what you just walked into, but it's not going to be like the other shit you've seen. And so that's important. And then the opso stood up and talked about having a child with, that was born with birth defection. No lower digestive tract, and all that they have to do, and how challenging it's been, how beautiful his daughter is, but how life-changing it has been for him. And standing up there, and then also some of the things people have said that have been brutal about her. And just to see, as Marines hear these stories, so I'm sitting normally down off to the side as they stand up and tell these stories. And you can't hear a pin drop in the room. Because this is real life shit. It's not, hey, we all know mental health's important, and Mac here is going to be here. It's not like that. It is people telling drop your jaw stories, and that land with a thud, right? And I always say the truth lands with a thud and needs no salesman. And you don't have to sell the shit to them. And then, I think the power of post-traumatic winning is in its truth. It's in its simple, plain-spoken truth that people look at and go, holy shit, where did this come from? And so that's awesome. So how do your discussions with your husband change, now that you've gone through, some education about these issues, and now he gets sensitized, and he essentially goes through, a period of instruction about it.
I think it'll be interesting to see how it changes. They've been deployed. They deployed shortly after the presentation.
Right.
But I'd say I think the biggest thing is that when this stuff happened last summer, I didn't want to talk about it, and I wasn't planning on talking about it. There's something I'll come back to really quick, but now looking back, I am grateful that I broke then, because I think if I hadn't broke then, I would have broken now during COVID and during the lockdown. And if I hadn't had, CBT helped me build a safety web of support that went in every single direction. It wasn't just about a lifeline, and it wasn't just about one set of tools or things. It was so many strategies across, physical fitness, mental, nutrition, life, faith, in all these, social, all these different directions that I felt okay, now even if one thread breaks, I'm going to be okay. And if I hadn't had that then, COVID wiped out half of my coping support, because, now it's just me and my son. My husband's deployed. There's not a lot of family support, because I have family members that are high risk. I can't hang out with friends in person. And so I'm very grateful for that. Because if I hadn't had, all this in-person support isn't happening right now. I'm sure there's some level of, essential care that still is happening. But, I'm grateful for that. One of the crazy things that happened to me at the very end of my CBT skills group was, so one thing that I haven't really talked about yet was through my time in high school, there were a couple friends that were with me in this path towards service academy life. And both of them were found not medically qualified by the stringent medical exam that we all have to go through as part of the application process. And one died of a medical condition the week that I was commissioned and graduated from the Naval Academy, and the other one had a heart condition and died right before I deployed to Afghanistan. And in a sense, I've always felt like my reasons to continue serving in the Marine Corps are because they can't and they couldn't and they wanted to. And that was, I think, another thing for me where, like, if I'm not giving my all, like, I'm not living in honor of their memory. And so on the last day of CBT, I had this really crazy vision where, like, one of the tools that we learned in CBT was, like, hey, if you're in a situation or you're somewhere and you just can't physically escape, like, well, you can mentally escape, like, create a imaginary thing in your mind where you can escape to. So one of the things I was like, well, the beach is a place where I find peace. And as I thought about it, it was like, well, I can have this beautiful, peaceful beach that I'm pretending to walk on and imagine and bring that to life in my mind. And I'm like, well, this isn't a real place. So, like, why shouldn't my friends be there? And so as it continued, like, hey, I can go for a walk with my friends that I haven't seen in 10 years because of what happened to them. And the last day of CBT, this vision had, like, a whole different element to it where I saw my friends that I knew, and then we took a turn on the beach and we saw all these other people, and the beach was just crowded full of people. And it was other members of the military, those that had died from died by suicide, and those that were now telling me, hey, look at what you learned. Now you have, like, now you know that you can get help and you can get better, and we don't have a voice anymore, but you do. And now you need, like, we need you to talk and tell people that your life matters. No matter how dark it seems, you can find light again, and you just need to ask for help and speak up. And once that happened to me, I knew that I had to write about what I had learned, and, you know, that's what started me on the path towards getting in contact with you.
What what do you think keeps people from getting help?
Fear.
Fear of?
Well, I think there's a couple things. Like, there's, in one sense, like, I didn't take my mental health as seriously as I took my physical health. You know, the approach that Marines take to physical health is like, hey, I'm gonna go to the gym every day and get better, because I want to be as strong as I possibly can be, as fast as I possibly can be. But when it comes to mental health, and people are like, oh, how are you doing? Good. How are you today? Fine. We're like, that's bullshit. Like, nobody is being honest with themselves about how they're really feeling. About, you know, no, I'm struggling. I feel trapped right now. I am overwhelmed and stressed. Or, you know, do you really want to know? Let's have a conversation. And the approach we take to our mental health is like, oh, no, I'm good, instead of, hey, maybe I can take a step every single day to get better. If we all took that collective approach, I think we wouldn't wait. Like, I wouldn't have reached the point that I had to go to the ER. I would have learned tools along the way to dial back and, like, hey, I'm being really negative and hard on myself right now. Like, why?
Like, do you think it's harder for people? I mean, you're an achiever, right? I mean, you've gone to the Naval Academy. You're a Marine officer. Is it harder for people that are achievers to ask for help. And again, I think women are in a difficult predicament because, you know, you can't hang. What's going on, right? I mean, you're everything we've told you you were. You're weak. You're not an equal, and now you're going to prove it to us, right? I mean, is it harder for women? I mean, I think it is.
I think that we could probably give different reasons, but like once I wrote my personal after action on the CBT skills group and I started sharing it with fellow peers, like it didn't matter, like even outside the military, everybody that I shared it with privately could relate. And that's when I realized like, this isn't just an officer problem. This isn't just a female problem. It's universal. And I think the fear is universal because we don't know what people are going to say. Like, I mean, I thought I was going to get fired and an adverse fit rep and maybe even something else that was going to be career ending. Like, honest to God, until I got my fit rep after the end of that period, well, I...
What else could they do to you other than like, give you an adverse fit to support and end your career?
Like, I expected that was going to happen. And then when it didn't, I was just blown away. And I was like, okay, I guess my life will go on.
Well, let me ask you this. You haven't seen post-traumatic warning. At some point you will, though. How important, though, do you think it is to have peers stand in front of us? I mean, because I will tell you this. You know, suicide rate in the 2nd Marine Division down 50% this year because of post-traumatic warning. It's the only thing they did different than everybody else. And I think the power of it is that it destigmatizes it. It says, hey, we're all fucking dealing with it. So, you know, the first commandment, stop faking it. Stop faking it like you don't struggle, right? Do you have thoughts on how it's further destigmatized? Because until here's why I say it's important. You know, I described who stands up and talks, right? My preference is it be somebody senior in the organization. Why is that important? Because young Marines don't think that older Marines are dealing with this shit, right? Oh, he's a lieutenant colonel. She's a captain. He's a first sergeant. He's a sergeant major, right? They don't have my problems. And then... the second day, maybe the morning of the third day that I did this ever at Camp Lejeune for the 2nd Marine Division, General Finesse stood up and spoke. And this is what I love about my friends. You don't have to boot them in the ass because they're leaders and they give a shit. And with no encouragement from me, he said, let me tell you about what I struggle with. And I was sitting on the side and I'm like, uh-oh. Where's this going? And he talked about what it's like to have 100 Marines under his command killed in combat. Everyone dies executing orders that I had given. And that he had called every family. And that before those phone calls, he was scared because he didn't know what they would say. Would they blame him? You know, and even though he didn't have to do that, he thought it was his responsibility to do that. And so he talked about that. And he talks about those families asked him one thing, please make my son's sacrifice count for something. And he said, I watch the news now, and I'm not sure if that sacrifice is going to ultimately count for anything in Iraq or Afghanistan. You know? And I wonder if they hate me, if they think I lied to them. He said, and that hurts me. It hurts my heart. And he said, but that's not the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And then he tells the story of the day he found out that his 4-year-old daughter was mentally retarded. And he can't tell the story without his voice cracking. And you can imagine, you know, the theater at Lejeune is 1,100 seats, 1,400 seats, something like that. And there's Marines and all. And they're sitting there with their jaws hanging open, like, because he's a general. He can't know what they go through. And so, to me, it's important that those stories get told so that they understand. It's really important that senior people stand up and tell the fucking truth. And when they, and here's what I've learned. When they do that, they tell everybody subordinate to them, this is what I expect from you. And once you do that, my experience is that you give permission for them to come tell you the truth. And they will, and they want to, because they're in there struggling by themselves, groping in the dark. How the fuck do I deal with this?
Mm-hmm.
How the fuck do I deal with it? And it's not just a few. It's the vast majority, right? The vast majority of people are in there struggling. So I'm curious about your thoughts on all that. I mean, because that's how you mainstream this, and that's how we make the numbers go the other way, when there is nothing fucking wrong with you. This is normal. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I really think that it, part of it is ownership, and that that leaders have a responsibility. We have a responsibility to ourselves to be honest with ourselves first, to then be able to open that door, and that when someone comes to us with a struggle or something, it's not a handoff. Like, it's not our responsibility to hand off to the MFLAC necessarily, you know, the military family life counselor or somebody else. Like, if you have the tools to help, then you can help right then and there, and you can be a resource. And I think while those other kind of support staff, they're super value added and they are like a great initial step. I think if all of the leaders were more trained and equipped to, one, like, personally deal with this throughout your career, then you could help yourself, you can help the Marines you work with, you can help your peers, you can help your family. And I think I've also heard, you know, the VA offers similar programs, but like, we shouldn't be waiting until people are out to be training them how to deal with intense stress in their lives.
Don't try to get me to snap. I know what you're fucking doing here. Don't bait me into fucking going off. Why the fuck am I, as a retired infantry officer, going around and telling people about man's search for meaning and how deeply that speaks to people of service? I do this program all the time. On Thursdays, two of my friends come on, Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenney. So Jeff Kenney hadn't watched the Vietnam War series that Ken Burns did. So he says, I'm going to watch it. And it came out in 2017. I thought, you know what? I'll watch it again, too, because, right, the second time you read something, you always glean something different from it. I thought, well, that'll be interesting. So I turned the son of a bitch on. In the first 5 minutes, there's a Army officer. He's an amputee. His name's Max Cleland. He develops the vet center concept. He becomes a senator for the state of Georgia. And guess who the fuck he mentions in the first thing he says? Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning. And I watch it and I'm like, holy fuck. Now, why didn't somebody tell me about that? Why didn't somebody tell me there's ways to give your suffering meaning? And the way that you're going to give your suffering meaning is you're going to learn about it, and then you're going to give these secrets to other people, and you're going to transform their lives. Would you be interested in that, Mac? I would have grabbed him by the fucking throat and said, tell me about it right fucking now, I'm going to kill you. And so I'm with you. Like, I don't get it. I don't get it. It's my great frustration with the PhDs that run these fucking programs. And I believe that they're so distant from us. I believe they're not from our tribes. And so they give us what they think, you know, that either we want. They certainly don't give us what we need. And that's the mission of post-traumatic winning, is to go and make people, you're a part of one of two audiences, right? you're part of an audience that is already in the black place. You've experienced trauma in your life, you've struggled, and you're in there struggling, and you're groping. And then there's people that aren't there yet. But as I say, nobody gets to the car wash without getting wet. And so what you can do with the people that are there, you can show them the path. You can turn on the light and say, there's a path for you. And it's a well-worn path. It's a path that has been walked by, you know, the prisoners of the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam. It's a path that's been walked by many people. It involves truth. It involves your reconciliation and then your selfless giving to others. Are you willing to go there? And then you get an answer. And then for people that aren't in there, you give them this wisdom, and then when it does happen to them, they'll come to you or email you or call you and say, how do I ever thank you, man? My father committed suicide, and I knew what to do because of that class, and I just want to thank you. And I know this is not theoretical for me. I live it. And I don't get, to end this little snap that you started, I don't get why this isn't presented up front. And now the data behind, you know, what's going on in the 2nd Marine Division, you know, it's like, oh, my God, look what happened. Well, no shit, man. You told them the truth, and then you challenged them. I want you to save each other. I want the 98% of you out there that aren't really struggling with this to roll up on the 2% that are, and I want you to save them and help them and love them. And if you as a leader don't understand leadership as an act of love, that you're more coach than drill instructor, then you need to get the fuck out, as Gerald Mattis says. Because you don't get it. So you have the floor now that you've caught that. So congratulations.
Yeah, I think part of it is we don't, like, in terms of everything that we get evaluated on as leaders, like, nobody's grading you on authenticity. Nobody is, like, really looking at somebody and saying, like, well, how well do they really, like, live in accordance with, you know, how good they look on paper? And I think, like, you can get some of that from the evaluation process, but, I mean, those are the leaders that I want to follow, the ones that are willing to be open and honest and share their experiences, because they're the ones that I know, like, that, you know, yeah, if something's really crummy, they're not going to sugarcoat it. They're going to be right there, like, in that shit with me and help me work through it. And
they're not going to make you feel like there's anything wrong with you, because this is a normal part of life. And then two, I don't know, you can't, some people, and I say this all the time, if you won't go here and lead in this realm, you're not a fucking leader. You are nominally in charge of that shit. But to be a leader is to go here and to care about them and to lead them, to truly give of yourself and lead. That's what servant leadership is. And we sit through the fucking classes, and everybody says, oh, yeah, that's the way you should do it. But then there's a lot of people that are scared shitless to go there, all right, that are scared shitless to go there. And it's the difference between, you know, some asshole that's in charge and somebody who's truly a leader, who truly gives. And I don't know how you quantify that. I don't know how you influence that. I don't know how you make people want to be that. I don't know how you take away the fear from, geez, do I really want to go there? How do you not go there?
I mean, it's still scary. I mean, I was scared before this call. Like, I was scared before the article went live in January.
Baby.
But every single time, like,
what happened?
I don't get negative feedback. Like, what I get from it is, like, people that I knew, that I thought I knew, like, our friendship goes deeper because now I'm learning about something that they have dealt with that, like, you know, we were roommates at TBS and I didn't know things about them that I have just learned, like, in the last 6 months.
And it's like, I mean, I guess you kind of called it like the secret sauce of relationships.
What was the catalyst for all of it? You tell him the truth, right?
Yeah, me freaking throwing my
shit in the middle of the room, right? What I've seen over and over is that when you tell the truth about yourself, you give them permission to tell the truth about themselves. And Janelle and I were talking about this before we came on, and in my effort to talk her off the ledge, because I knew she'd be nervous. But I'm 62 years old. I have people come up and tell me stunning stuff that they never told anybody. Why? Because I'll stand up there and I'll talk about my life and I'll tell the truth, and it's not pretty, right? And I'll tell them there's a path for them, that there's light for them. And the combination of being honest and giving them hope, and it's not, and again, as Chanel said, it's not sugarcoated. The Eighth Commandment doesn't say anymore, stop abusing drugs and alcohol. It says quit. Now that's no bullshit. That's no bullshit. But it's the truth. And when Janelle read it, she knew it was true. Now, she might say, hey, fuck you, I ain't doing that. Right? But she'll be forced to confront that every time that she drinks and every time the demons come out of the woodwork, because the alcohol allows the demons to escape. And the demons come after your kids, they come after the people you love and your friends. And then she's going to be forced to think about it again, because that's like a rock in your shoe. That old McNamara bullshit, you gotta stop, but I can't. Maybe I need some help. And so to me, it's that strength that comes out of the truth in all of this. But, right, when you tell the truth, all it does, and it's amazing to hear people's stories about how that then motivated somebody else to tell them, which opened up this door to these discussions, which further changed both your lives. Which I say is the beauty of post-traumatic quitting. It's good on top of 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 good, and it keeps fucking getting better. Right, right? Now she's laughing. She was kind of shitless before this. Right? But all this stuff is the fucking truth, and why it's so hard for our culture to embrace it is beyond me. Absolutely beyond me. So, what do you have to say about that?
I agree. and I think that, I'm still young, so I have a lot of years to continue to apply and learn and continue to apply, not only your tools and commandments, but, keeping an open mind to any suggestion and not just writing it off with like, oh, that sounds stupid, or I don't think that would work. Like, no, make your judgment after you try it. I'm at the point now where I'm not dealing with headaches. I'm not on medication, and everything that was recommended by the behavioral health doc or by like your PDF, everything's worked. So I just try to keep track of I just try to keep track of every single little thing, and like, okay, well, if my day feels off, did I do these things this morning? Did I do these things in the middle of the day? Okay, well, all right, now I need to jump in and do some of these other things. And over time it's worked. Like, I'm not waking up with my head pounding every day. I wake up with a clear head, and I just am so, like, I thank God for that gift first thing in the morning. It's like, oh, I wake up and my head's clear. Thank you. And, like, just being able to start my day with gratitude changes everything.
No, again, but my frustration now more and more is with people that run mental health. And I'm not a hater, or at least I try not to be. But, I get frustrated because they're obstinate in terms of what I get is, oh, Mac, they need more than a pep talk, which makes my eyebrows go up. What the fuck did you say? You think that this is a pep talk? Really? So why don't you stick it up your condescending ass there, stud? But I'm frustrated, you know, with the pace of it, because there's a better way. And what I've said, and I believe, and it's gonna happen. It's gonna happen. But we can be the catalyst in the culture to change this. First inside the DOD, then at every college and university and every high school around the country. We can. Our culture can. And to me, that's exciting. So instead of being, you know, a disabled veteran limping back to your community, you're an enabled veteran, wise beyond your years and able to contribute to the mental health and the wellness of your community. And all that starts with is, hey, man, can I talk to you? Do you got a minute? You know there's nothing wrong with you, right? That this is normal in life. And there's a path that you can walk. And I'd be happy to show it to you. What? Like, are you a therapist? Fuck no, man. I used to be a Marine. Right? And then you laugh. But we deal with this shit. And I know I can help you. How do you know? Because I fucking do. That's how. Because I've done it before. And then all you do is you tell them the truth. And it will be this, I mean, exactly the story that Janelle has told. Right? As I read, as I learn, as I follow, as I'm honest, and as I embrace the truth, my life gets better and better and better and better. And you know, what happens every time that you have one of these episodes where you talk about it, somebody contacts you, what does that do for your day?
It brightens my day.
Yeah.
It helps give even more meaning to it, because it, you know, I feel like, you know, if this happened to me so that I could, you know, it happened to me and it sucked when it happened and I was not excited about it, but seeing how it can help other people or just help my own life in different stages as I continue to move past it and look back, it's like, hey, this was a dark place. This was not good, but you know, this is part of my experience. This is who I am, and I am the person I am today because I went through that.
Yeah, but again, I think one of the most important things that we as grown-ups have to tell people is that, look, man, everybody goes through it. Everybody deals with it, and it's not like you're going to stop dealing with it now that you've spent some time in the sunlight. You're gonna have to deal with it in the future too. It is a constant in life. And so the key to dealing with it are these things, in my opinion. There are these three goals and eight commandments. I mean, and you've talked about it. When you don't live with self-discipline, when you don't take care of your body, when you don't take care of your mind, when you don't stay connected to your tribe and the people who love you that you can confide in, what happens to your life? It gets fucked up. It's like, oh, really? What a fucking shock. You know? So, you gotta live with discipline. You gotta live with some self-discipline in your life. And if you don't, I will guarantee you, if you have this shit in your life, it is going to a bad place. Well, that's like stupid stuff, right? I mean, like, monkeys could even learn shit like that. I think. I mean, so to me, it's the key to living a great life is understand these truths. And then every time you give, like I said, you know, people that have contacted me, people say, how do you do that? Oh, you don't understand. This is joy waiting to happen. Right? And it's going to be joy. And so these are happy moments in my day. I don't need to recover from this. It is the greatest high. And that's what sustains, I think, what sustains the change. Is the natural high of changing somebody else's life, the natural high of affirming that I can be of help, the natural high that knowing that there is nothing wrong with me, that everybody goes through this, and that I'm okay. But I wish, again, to continue to hammer the point you made, is I wish we were further out in front of this. I wish we were further out in front of this. What's been the most significant thing out of all of this that's happened to you?
That's a tough one.
This is a tough interview.
I mean,
come on, fuck, you're a major in the Marine Corps.
I think it just, I guess having the, I don't know.
I'll give you one that people that people struggle with. I'll give you one that people struggle with a lot, and you kind of alluded to it earlier. And that is, I'm not the chrome, like, beautiful piece of art that I have in my head, right? That I am a flawed human being. And I think that's, initially, that's hard to accept. Right, that I have this vision of myself. You have a vision of yourself as a mom, right, as a Marine officer, as a person, as a girl from Rancho Vista High School, right, and the United States Naval Academy. That's all of you. And we have this image of ourselves. And then all of a sudden, you know, that image gets tarnished. Well, that's you too. Hello. And I think, until you understand that everybody deals with that, but it's not the way we look at ourselves, and I think that's a hard step to make, and I think that's where a lot of the anxiety and the fake in it and the self-induced turbulence comes from. It's that I didn't know that everybody was struggling with this. And that's, again, the significance of somebody like General Finesse standing up and talking about what he struggles with. I didn't know. And the week after that happened, the week after the first time we did it, he called me and goes, "You can't believe what's going on here." And I said, "What?" He goes, "I can't go anywhere without Marines coming up to me." I can't remember, we did it for maybe 13,000 Marines that week, 12,000 Marines, something like that. And he said, "That class is unbelievable." And I said, "Well," I said, "it is the class, but the other part of it was what you did. You know, they looked at you as like a G.I. Joe figurine, you know, plastic general, you know, the next guy who took over. You changed that when you stood up and talked to them the way you spoke." And the two comments that I received were always throughout the week were, "Wow, I've never seen a class like this." Second was, "And I've never seen a general do anything like that." I said, so the two of them are extremely powerful. And what you told the people out there that were struggling was that it's normal to struggle and it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And anybody who's been struggling in life, to hear that from somebody who they respect, that's huge. That's huge. And so I think that's one of the things that is the hardest thing. We all have an ideal self-image of ourselves, you know, especially as Marines. We're driven, we're problem solvers, we're tough. It's why we join the organization. And then you find out, right, that, you know, that you can't ignore it anymore. That it does take a toll on you, and you are flawed, and you can't get yourself out of it. And little do you know that everybody else is having the same discussion too. I think that crossing that threshold is huge. And that's why I think the importance of post-traumatic winning is standing up before they get there and say, "Hey, this is normal. Don't be afraid of it," right? This is how you get through it. You talk to people. The first person you should talk to is your spouse. What? Yeah, you can talk to your spouse about this shit. And stay connected to your besties, okay? And don't be afraid to go there with them. And you got to go there with your spouse and your besties, because any relationship that you create with a therapist is going to be impermanent. And so the permanent relationship, the permanent therapist is who? Your spouse, your best friend. The impermanent one, with everybody. I don't know anybody who's had like a 50-year relationship with a therapist. it doesn't happen, or even a 20-year, or a 15-year, or a 10-year, or a 5-year relationship, for God's sake. So that relationship comes and goes. So what's been a hardest thing for you?
I think just, I guess I'm not really scared anymore about talking. I mean, I am scared about talking about it. But just knowing that, like, every day I have to keep doing everything. But it's not like a burden to do all those little things. It's like I learned the blueprint to approach each day, which means that, like, if a storm comes and I, like, sometimes, you know, like, I'll still have those days when, like, you just gotta cry and you feel that squall coming and you know, it's like, but I know that it's gonna pass. So I think it's like, it's hard, but because I now have seen both sides, it's like, hey, I know these trials are gonna come and like, I can't just try to push them off because, you know, you're holding back a storm. You know, you just gotta let the storm come, let it pass, and move on. And accept it as it comes instead of trying to act like there's no storm.
Quit faking it. Do you think that a program like this should be resident at the service academies? The Air Force Academy just had 2 suicides a month ago. You're talking about high pressure, high achievers. Do you think the academies should have more programs like this?
I think that that it should be integrated, and different aspects of this should be integrated between service academies, MCMAP, SEER school. Like, those are places that, like, once I went through CBT, I was like, how have I not learned this in 9 years of active duty and the schools that I went through and the things, like, why did I not learn some of the techniques of how to, like, pump myself back up in some of those high-pressure situations? Like, you get inoculated to stressful situations, but you don't necessarily get, like, the tactics and tools of really succeeding on the other side of it, where it's not rocket science. It's just stuff that I guess you learn if you get a master's in social work, where it doesn't need to be resident there. I think it's his knowledge that can help anybody anywhere. And I think the structure, like, we want, like, the structure's there that they try to teach honor and courage and commitment and core values, but they teach it sort of in an externally focused way, in a leadership way, instead of like, no, start with yourself. You need to be honest with yourself and courageous about becoming the best you that you can be, and have the commitment to, if you recognize that you're not on where you need to be, that, like, you're going to commit to get the help you need and take that first step to get the help you need so that you can be the best that you can be, which makes you a shining light for others around you instead of pretending that you're good when you're not.
All right, final question, and this is the general question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about what you've gone through, what you've learned, you know, as you've gone through it, that you want people to know?
I think my closing thing will just be that that, you know, if you you shouldn't be afraid, you know, don't let fear be the thing that keeps you from taking that first step. Because, yeah, everyone's scared, so just step out anyways. Like, you're swimming in the ocean. Are you just going to stand on the shore and watch the waves? Like, no, you got to get through the breakers if you're going to find, like, the calm water. Just take that first step, and you will be, hopefully you'll be in a place where, you know, people will be around you to help you. And if not, you know, call Mac, call me, send me a message, you know, find the people that are going to help you through it, because we can't get through this alone. And
no, that's good advice. I mean, it's hard, and everybody, you know, goes through it once, and you're nervous, and you know, yeah, you know, it's one thing to talk about it, but it's different to talk about it when it's you, and that's always different. So, but again, you know, Janelle's right. Don't be afraid. And you can call me, and if you want to get in touch with her, email me, and I'll put you in touch with her. And but again, there's nothing wrong with you. We all go through it, and so don't be afraid. And the only thing that's going to happen, as Janelle has talked about in her life, the only thing that's going to happen is your life's going to get better, and you're going to improve the lives of other people by your honesty. And that's her experience. That's my experience in spades. And so get off your dead ass and get moving. Let's go. Janelle, first of all, thank you for doing this today. And congratulations on where you've been, you know, the process that you've gone through as a person, and could be happier for you. And also that you're a member of the 1-5 family. And I hope you don't mind in the future if I call you back and bring you back on and we do this again.
Okay. I look forward to talking with you again, and hopefully we can meet in person one of these days too.
Well, you're right down the road, so we will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. That is Janelle Hamp, Major, United States Marine Corps. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.